Today is Saturday, May 18, 1996.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Efforts are intensifying to recover parts of the ValueJet DC-9, which crashed in the Florida Everglades a week ago, killing all 110 people on board. Today, divers will don new lightweight biohazard suits so they can safely search the crater which swallowed the plane. If the divers locate chunks of the aircraft, barges will be brought in to try to retrieve the pieces. On Monday, searchers plan to begin using experimental radar equipment to detect items buried in the mud. President Clinton defended his record on welfare reform in his weekly radio address today. The president said that since he took office, 38 states have been granted waivers to revamp their welfare systems. He said the number of Americans on welfare has declined by 1.3 million people and that food stamp rolls have also shrunk.
The state-based reform we have encouraged has brought work and responsibility back to the lives of 75% of the Americans on welfare. We're doing a lot more than signing waivers. We've also pressed ahead on fundamental reforms to make the welfare system reflect the basic values that have stood us so well for so long. That if you bring a child into this world, you must take responsibility for that child. That government will not subsidize irresponsible or reckless behavior. That welfare is a second chance, not a way of life.
But the president said more needs to be done, and he called on Congress to pass a law requiring welfare recipients to work, limiting the length of time people can stay on welfare, and toughening child support enforcement. In northern Bosnia, British and Czech troops were deployed today to protect four busloads of Muslims who wanted to return to see their former homes. But despite the presence of the NATO troops, a mob of Serbs blocked the road and refused to allow the Muslims to proceed. Malcolm Brabant has more for the BBC.
Negotiators for the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, tried to convince Serb police to escort a small group of Muslim refugees to visit their homes from which they were ethnically cleansed at the start of the Bosnian War. They argued that under the Dayton Peace Accord, the Muslims were entitled to cross into the Republika Srpska. But reason failed. A large mob of Serb men, waving sticks, shouting abuse and making obscene gestures, advanced on the UNHCR and forced them to retreat. British soldiers on station to deter any violence donned flak jackets and helmets, battened down the hatches of their warrior fighting vehicles, and withdrew a short distance to block the road down which the mob was travelling. Later, the Serbs said there would be no crossings, arguing that the war was too fresh in people's memories. They said that they would only allow groups of four or five Muslims to cross in the future without such a large NATO and media presence.
The BBC's Malcolm Brabant. Italy has a new prime minister today. Romano Prodi was sworn in. This is NPR News in Washington. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will begin poisoning more than 5,000 seagulls today. The breeding gulls are overpowering other bird species for nesting space on an island off Cape Cod. Yesterday, a federal appeals court rejected efforts to stop the killings. Wildlife officials say the gull population is so large, it's threatening other species who nest on the island, including terns, laughing gulls, and American black ducks. Jury members have been given the weekend off in the Whitewater trial in Little Rock, Arkansas. UPI's Judy Jordan has details.
Did David Hale tell the truth to the Whitewater jury in the fraud and conspiracy trial of President Clinton's former business partners? That's the question the 9-woman, 3-man jury is attempting to answer as they deliberate the evidence and decide the fate of Arkansas's highest office holder. Political pundits speculate that if the three defendants are found guilty, it will be a rejection of the president's credibility. The jury has gone home for the weekend and will resume their work on the case on Monday. Judy Jordan, Little Rock.
Efforts to persuade anti-government freemen in Montana to surrender will resume today. Two bargaining sessions were held yesterday with negotiators seated in folding chairs while armed guards for both sides stood by. Negotiator Colorado State Senator Charles Duke told a news conference some progress was made, but he can't see the end yet. The freemen are wanted on a variety of charges, ranging from writing millions of dollars in worthless checks to threatening to murder a federal judge. The handwritten final paragraph of a speech Abraham Lincoln gave predicting the end of slavery has been sold at auction for nearly $500,000. The speech was part of the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates held in 1858 when Lincoln unsuccessfully challenged Stephen Douglas for a U.S. Senate seat from Illinois. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon.
Well, it's good to be out of Washington, D.C. Good to be in the heartland of America.
Bob Dole stumping in Chicago Thursday, a man of the Capitol who will now resign his Senate seat and be a full-time candidate for president. Dan Shore joins us now to review this and other news of the week. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott.
And who knew Mr. Dole had been so unhappy for 35 years in Washington? This decision was a surprise, even a shocker for people who like to think that they're in the know. Insofar as you can tell, why did Senator Dole take such a dramatic and unexpected step?
Well, funny, you know, stunning though it was when we heard it, in retrospect, it looks as though it must have been inevitable. His strategy of running from the Senate floor was just not working. The bills that he wanted to send to President Clinton to veto were not being passed because of various divisions in the Republican Party. At one point, he challenges President Clinton to a one-on-one meeting to try to agree on a balanced budget, and then he has to back out of that meeting because he's not sure he can rally his own troops. Mm-hmm. So Congress begins to look not like a launching platform, but a graveyard for his campaign. And now that he's done, I said, yes, of course he had to.
So it does make strategic political sense, first off.
Well, it makes strategic political sense. Whether it's going to make sense, whether enough sense to sort of really be a relaunching of his campaign, I guess, as in the old saying, time will tell. And we'll see. You can get Dole out of the Senate more easily than you can get the Senate out of Dole. I'm not sure whether a campaign consists of just simply one great speech, and his resignation speech was really probably the greatest speech he's ever made. However, that speech was written for him by Mark Halperin, a novelist, conservative columnist in the Wall Street Journal, who has written a novel about a wounded soldier who maybe did and maybe did not die. So maybe that's what we're waiting to learn from Mark Halperin, who, among many other things, served in the Israeli army. So to say that because there was one great speech made a profound impression, I don't know if he can carry off this illusion of being a born-again instant outsider. Mm-hmm. The idea of being free at last, you suggest. Who's been keeping him in chains all this time? So now he goes to the heartland, as he calls it, Chicago, and tonight to tobacco country in North Carolina, where he's gotten a lot of his campaign money from, to go there for the Winston auto race. Well, free at last, we'll see.
Does his departure from the Senate mean a resolution of some of the issues that have been hard to get through the Congress this election year?
Well, there are two ways of arguing that. It could be argued that not having to worry so much about Senator Dole's campaign priorities should simplify matters for the Republicans in Congress, and they should be able more easily to reach compromises on issues like minimum wage, like the health insurance, the gas tax cut. Mm-hmm. But the other way of looking at this is that the conservative Senate Democrats are also unleashed, and they may also feel freer now to be more intractable and to join House Republicans on matters like an anti-union rider in the minimum wage bill. I suspect, Scott, that on this matter of whether Congress is going to go full speed ahead or continue in a kind of a modified gridlock is one where we have to wait for the dust to settle and find out what life is like in Congress, life after Dole.
There was another surprise, of course, this week of a more tragic circumstance. Admiral Jeremy Mike Borda, who enlisted in the Navy at the age of 17, worked his way through the ranks to preside over the U.S. Navy, took his life. He left notes suggesting he wanted to spare his family and his Navy a scandal over the fact that he'd worn combat V-pins over two of the medals he received during the war in Vietnam, although he may never have actually served on a ship that drew fire. Help us understand what seems to many so small and particular a point could drive a man to despair.
Help you understand. I wish I could also. If I understand, I'll let you know. But I don't believe in this kind of pop psychology where you try to read a tortured mind. I was one of those who did not try, for example, to read the mind of Vincent Foster. There are things about a complex thing like that which we will never know. But the external things we do know. We know that Admiral Borda's suicide note addressed to my sailors expressed his fear that the scandal over the decoration would hurt the reputation of the Navy, already so badly damaged by a series of things, sexual harassment, drugs, discipline problems in Annapolis, in the academy. And so, you know, it looked to me as though this had the character of not being a thing all by itself, but a kind of a last straw.
Mm-hmm. We should explain the state today. A number of naval experts, I guess maybe most prominently former Chief of Operations Elmo Zumwalt, says that the Admiral, in his judgment, was entitled to wear those pins.
There is no indication that he deliberately wore these two Vs that he was not entitled, maybe not entitled to wear. His only indication that when he was told last year that he might not be entitled to wear, he stopped wearing it. I mean, to try to go into this incident in itself somehow kind of misses the larger point.
Yeah.
This was only the tip of a terrible iceberg.
Do you anticipate, maybe you've already felt it, some adverse public reaction towards the news industry for even pursuing this story?
I have felt it. I just happened to be on a local talk show yesterday, and on talk shows people are raising the question of the media, whether the media shouldn't investigate, and we drove him to it, and all of that. You know, there are other matters that could be raised. For example, if you're thinking of sources of grief for Admiral Borda, a couple of weeks ago, the former Secretary of the Navy, James Webb, speaking at Annapolis, attacked Borda without mentioning his name for not being sufficiently protective of officers who were involved in the tailhook sex harassment scandal, right? Mm-hmm. So they didn't blame him, but they'd like to blame the media. It's hard to see how Newsweek could have anticipated a suicide in the course of pursuing what looked like a totally legitimate story. But, you know, press bashing has now become a reflex in our country. They will not forgive us our press passes.
Oh, gosh. The Federal Aviation Administration has come under criticism this week for perhaps not paying sufficient attention to the safety and repair record of ValueJet. Of course, a crash, one of those airlines, and the airliners in the Everglades killed 110 passengers. Do you foresee the conduct of the FAA becoming a concern for Congress now?
Well, it's interesting you say the FAA, because most people are talking about ValueJet and whether ValueJet should have been flying and all of that. Mm. Well, everything involving government action does become a concern of Congress at one point or another, and there will be congressional hearings. And the issue, of course, as you suggested, is not just the performance of ValueJet, which did have more problems than other discount airlines did, but the performance of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. There was an internal report in the FAA which indicated they realized that they were not adequately monitoring ValueJet's safety problems. Mm-hmm. And I suppose when Congress looks at this, they will be looking for villains, and they will easily find villains in the aviation industry where everything is not always perfect and where things don't always function as they should function. I wonder, though, whether Congress will now repeat in the course of this all the speeches that they love to make about getting the regulators off our backs, because it is clear, if anything is clear from this, that we need regulation in many, many respects, and simply saying get rid of the regulators is not an answer to many of our problems.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about this finally, if we could. Someone we both knew, Willis Conover, a long time jazz host on The Voice of America, died late last night in Washington, D.C.
Yes. Well, I only met Willis Conover himself recently when I was at the Voice of America. Let me also say that in my years in Eastern Europe, as I went around places like Poland, I found in the course of interviewing people that they may not know much about who the President of the United States was, but everybody knew the name of Willis Conover. Mm-hmm. They were devoted to his bringing jazz to them. They thought of him as simply the heartland of the heart of America was the way they looked at him. Mm-hmm. And so when it came to Willis Conover, I came back to the States and I said, I must meet this guy. And eventually met him. And he was really quite impressed when I told him how big he was in Poland, in Bulgaria, and in the Soviet Union.
Well, we're going to take advantage of the sad circumstance of his departure to talk a little bit more about Willis Conover. Dan, thanks for being with us. See you next week.
I wait to hear you.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan Shore. This final note from the week's news.
Time for jazz. Willis Conover in Washington, D.C. with The Voice of America Jazz Hour.
The Voice of America died late last night. Willis Conover was 75 and had cancer. The news of Willis's death might strike more deeply overseas, especially in Moscow, Warsaw, Budapest, and Bucharest, the coldest precincts of the old Cold War. In the decades before broadcast satellites beamed CNN, NPR, NBA basketball, and Baywatch around the world, Willis Conover might have been the most identifiable American voice on this planet. His jazz show had an estimated weekly audience of 30 million people. When Willis began the show in 1955, America was not only engaged in a Cold War overseas, but often at home. There were complaints about America beaming music to the world that was so palpably spontaneous and free. The music of Harlem, Chicago South Side, New Orleans, Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, and Duke Ellington. Music, to put a point on it, that might have seemed more startling 40 years ago, of black Americans, when much of the United States was still legally segregated. Willis Conover told us in 1987.
When we Americans were holding down black Americans, jazz was born.
And so in Eastern Europe now it follows that people who are being...
People who have not had the opportunity that many Americans have to stand up and say and do what they choose to do.
Jazz is freedom music.
It's a personal freedom thing.
When we profiled Willis then, cancer had already ravaged his throat. He recorded a show in stops and starts, working, by the way, with a young engineer born in Russia who'd first heard his show as a youngster, stealthily searching through the scratch and screech of shortwave for music from America. While recording, Willis would spray his throat with some elixir, take in a deep breath, and speak in short spurts. It was demanding and exhausting to edit his replies for listenability by removing most of those breaths, but it reminded us how exhaustive and painful it must have been for Willis to keep on speaking. But he did. Not some gray-voiced state radio announcer, but a deep, fine voice sending out swing, big band, and bebop, the music of freedom, the voice of America. Time is now 18 minutes past the hour.